Thanks for tuning in for the January 28th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview highlights a qualitative study on the price of drugs for multiple sclerosis. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear a discussion on duration of American football play and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Please remember we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we also welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Neurology Podcast. I'm Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And today I'm very excited to be speaking with Dan Hartung. He is a pharmacist and researcher at Oregon State University College of Pharmacy. And today we're talking about the paper published by Dan and colleagues titled Gaming the System, a Qualitative Study on the Price of Drugs for Multiple Sclerosis. It was published in this week's issue of the Neurology Journal. And so obviously today we're continuing our conversation on drug pricing. For new listeners, there are many episodes from the past year on our podcast that are worth listening to on this topic. I especially recommend you go back and listen to our monthly delayed recall episode from October 2019. It highlights several of those interviews on drug pricing, including the one from May 27th with Brian Callaghan from the University of Michigan on his paper about rising out-of-pocket costs for neurologic medications. And so this week, in terms of introduction, it's hard to overstate the importance of drug pricing right now in our country. Amongst all the different health concerns discussed in the U.S., Americans report that lowering the cost of prescription drugs is the most important one. Drugs to treat patients with MS are frequently held up as an example of this problem. And Dan, as you discuss in your paper, the list prices for disease-modifying therapies for MS have more than doubled since 2010. And the average annual wholesale acquisition cost for many of these disease-modifying therapies exceeds over $80,000 a year. So today, Dan, we're excited you're here to tell us a little bit about your study on the cost of drugs for multiple sclerosis. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, it's great to be with you and talk about our paper.
So the qualitative format of your paper is interesting, and we'll get into that in just a second. But what would you say for our listeners is the take-home message from this paper?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, there's a really robust debate right now about drug pricing. And we often hear different sides of the argument about are prices too high? Are they going up too fast? And what are the ramifications of legislation and policy aimed at reducing price escalations in terms of reduced innovation and things like that? And so we thought it would be interesting to talk directly with individuals who we knew to be kind of intimately involved with drug pricing decisions. And so we decided to go forward and do some kind of qualitative interviews with individuals who at one point in their career had been involved in upper leadership and executive positions with firms that had produced drugs for multiple sclerosis. As you said, that multiple sclerosis has a class of medications that are commonly cited as increasing at rates that are above average and have been held up as an example of problems in the market for pharmaceuticals. And so, you know, in addition to our own interests of drug pricing for multiple sclerosis, I think multiple sclerosis is emblematic of a lot of different chronic conditions where high drug prices are problematic for a number of reasons.
Terrific. So you performed these kind of semi-structured interviews with four different leaders in the pharmaceutical industry. And I know you covered several topics with them, but what did they say when they were describing their decision-making process for setting a drug's initial price? What did you learn about that process?
Right. So we've done some previous quantitative analyses of list prices for MS products over their lifespan. And in a previous paper we published in Neurology, we found this kind of interesting phenomenon where as new MS products came online, their price was set essentially about the same as all the other products on the market or slightly above. And you'd see this kind of insidious creep in price over time where new products, particularly new innovative products, such as the first oral medication or the first infusion, would have a substantial premium to that price. And this would kind of lead to this insidious increase over time. And so I think what our qualitative study provides some additional insights is that this is not an accident and that the pricing decisions that these individuals reported on were largely based on what was the existing market for drugs that were already on the market. what was the ecology, the prices of those products. And there was care taken into consideration with respect to making sure that price setting didn't undercut the existing therapies too much. One individual suggested that that might telegraph perhaps inferiority of the product that they were bringing to market, but also making sure that they weren't sticking out too much or wasn't too much of a premium over the existing market. So I think there was a conscious effort to price drugs in line with the ecosystem, the existing market, but you know, with a conscious effort to make sure that they weren't undercutting other drugs on the market, but not sticking too far up above what everyone else was doing as well.
Obviously, many of the new drugs on the market, especially for a disease like MS, can be life-changing. And so I think it's important that, you know, we recognize the resources of investors and the innovation of researchers that make this possible for our patients. And certainly their innovation, their research development should be rewarded because no one wants to stifle the creation of new drugs. But, you know, that's frequently what we hear as the reason for these high drug prices, specifically to allow companies to recoup R&D costs. But did they in fact describe that research and development costs were a main factor in determining price setting or no?
That factor really wasn't brought up as hugely influential in their price setting decisions. There's this notion about needing to reward innovation, and that in terms of rewarding innovation, I think that there's a need by companies to increase revenues so that it's attractive to investors, increasing profits, making sure that these firms are growing. You know, they're publicly traded for-profit companies that people are investing in. And so executives at these companies need to make sure that they do have growth, and these companies are being compared to companies outside of healthcare industry, like other tech industries and things like that, where you need to show quarter-to-quarter growth, or you know, the investors will be unhappy, and then maybe those executives would be let go in favor of other executives who would be able to increase quarter-to-quarter growth and things like that. So I think that there is an eye just to making sure that there is corporate growth and increasing revenues and profits. And it wasn't specifically tied to, you know, we spent $800 million developing this drug. We have 5 years of market exclusivity that we need to recoup. And that didn't seem to be involved at all in the calculus for deciding what the entry price would be. It was more of, this is our portfolio of products. We need to grow our company. We need to increase revenue and profits so we can continue to attract investors. And that was more what was driving everything. There are different ways that companies can increase revenue, either through increased market penetration of their existing therapies or introduction of new therapies through innovation. So that's very difficult. And then price increases. And so I think prices are the easiest lever to pull to increase revenue for these companies.
This whole system feels very opaque. As physicians, we rarely know exactly what a drug is going to cost the patient sitting across from us. Patients usually don't find out what the drug will cost until they're there at the pharmacy, and it's difficult to know what the true cost of the drug really is and who's actually paying that amount. And one of the reasons that I think the system is so opaque is because of the middlemen, and you discussed this in the study, middlemen including pharmacy benefit managers. What did you learn about the role of middlemen in this whole process?
That's a great question. You know, this has been another big point of debate in the policy discussions that are being taken. You know, there are a lot of efforts in states to increase transparency and, you know, who's getting what money and what is the actual cost of these drugs versus what is the list price and the rebates and things of that nature. And unfortunately, we didn't get the perspective of other entities in the payer or drug distribution channel. In retrospect, maybe this would have strengthened the perspectives of our qualitative study. What I will say is that this wasn't really a major issue that was brought up by really any of our participants. One individual did mention that there's increased complexity of the payer channel did have some effects on pricing decisions, but it wasn't a major issue that was brought up in terms of a major factor related to either initial price setting or year-to-year price increases.
An idea we frequently discuss on our podcast when we're talking about drug pricing is that of a drug's potential for financial toxicity or the adverse effects that a drug's cost could have on a patient, just like we would similarly consider a drug's efficacy, its safety, tolerability, or convenience before prescribing it. And I'm curious whether the cost of the drug, whether that impact on patients came up at all in the interviews. And then as a follow-up to that, more broadly speaking to our audience, what can we as providers be doing to help our patients avoid financial toxicity?
Yeah, this is a very important point that's, I think, increasingly relevant for patients with MS because depending on your payer, you know, out-of-pocket costs can be very significant. It wasn't a major point of discussion in our conversations with these individuals. I think there were some seemed to be implicit recognition that there were systems in place to make sure that patients eventually access the medication, either patient assistance programs, copay support programs, things like that. I think that those are problematic in other ways, but it was not a major point of discussion. As you mentioned, like the out-of-pocket costs, depending on the payer, can be substantial. We've done some work that suggests that out-of-pocket costs in Medicare can exceed $6,000 a year for individuals with MS who are taking a disease-modifying therapies. Some of the legislation that's being actively discussed right now, in fact, I think that the House just passed one of their big drug pricing proposals, and they have specific elements in there that address at least out-of-pocket costs in the Medicare program, because there's no cap on out-of-pocket costs in the Part D program. So I think that this is an important area, and drug companies often point their fingers at payers, and payers often point their fingers at drug companies, but I think that there's culpability across the board on this issue.
There are many different solutions under debate as to how to fix this drug pricing problem. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that. We're recording this in mid-December, and just today, as you mentioned, the U.S. House voted to pass Speaker Pelosi's drug pricing bill that would allow HHS to negotiate the prices of a certain number of drugs each year using an international price index. On the other hand, an alternative potential solution, you know, we've had Steve Pearson of ICER, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, on our podcast, and his organization is focused on the clinical and economic benefit of drugs. And there are some people who think that a drug's value should really be considered highly when determining its price. And again, I'm not sure if this came up in any of the interviews, but even if it didn't, do you have any thoughts about the idea of a value-based assessment and pricing for drugs?
Yeah, so I think ICER, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, has been, to me, surprisingly influential in this space. I mean, historically, the U.S. market and kind of culture has really bristled at any attempt to introduce metrics related to cost per quality adjusted life year, cost effectiveness things. But their analyses over the last several years, I think, have been, to my surprise, pretty influential in modifying pricing behavior and affecting behavior for some drugs as they're released into the market. Like several drugs for other conditions have reduced their list price in response to recommendations about, you know, what is an appropriate price given the actual benefits of that particular drug. So I think that they are getting some traction and influence in terms of their work. So it's been great. And I know that their report, their kind of systematic review and health technology assessment on MS drugs wasn't particularly kind in terms of the value of those drugs and implying that in general the class is overpriced given the benefits that they confer to patients. So I think that as the U.S. confronts these extremes in pricing, especially for some of the new biologics and gene therapy-based therapies, that reports from ICER will be increasingly influential in at least providing pharmaceutical companies perhaps with like a roadmap for what is a reasonable price given the value of particular therapies. I'm not sure the political fate of this, you know, I don't think this, as is written, is going to have a lot of traction in the Senate, so I'm not sure exactly where it's going to go. You know, there's a lot of aversion to allowing Medicare to negotiate prices, which honestly is a little strange, but I understand it politically. But I think that the public is generally supportive of it. But as far as like being modified by the Senate and what its chances are being actually passed, I think it's unclear at this point.
Terrific. Dan, as we wrap up here, any other final thoughts from your paper that we haven't touched on so far?
Well, I think that myself and my neurologist colleague, Dr. Dennis Boudet at OHSU, kind of started on this research pathway to basically increase awareness by neurologists about this issue of like what the prices are and how they affect patient access and things like that. And so, you know, I think just making sure that neurologists understand the cost implications of some of the products that they prescribe for patients. I also think it's worthy to discuss the fact that there is now a FDA-approved generic within the disease-modifying therapy class. Glatiramer acetate has been available for several years as an FDA-approved generic product, and the list price for that over the last 12 months has dropped tremendously. I think the annual list price for generic glatiramer is about $20,000 a year compared to about $80,000 a year for many of the other products. So in terms of someone who has a high deductible or coinsurance type structure, prescribing a generic would be a way to save patients money out of pocket, depending on their payment and their insurer.
Well, that's terrific. Dan, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for your time and discussing your paper. Once again, the title of this paper is Gaming the System, a Qualitative Study on the Price of Drugs for Multiple Sclerosis, and you can find it in this week's issue of the Neurology Journal. Dan, thanks again for your time.
Great. Well, thank you for talking to me. It was very enjoyable.
Hi, this is David Lapidus. Today we have on the phone Jesse Mez, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Boston University, Director of the Clinical Core of Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center. He's a Framingham Heart Study Investigator and CTE Center Investigator. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The last time we spoke on the August 29, 2017 podcast about your paper in JAMA on chronic traumatic encephalopathy in American football players, and today we're going to discuss your recent paper in the Annals of Neurology published October 7th titled Duration of American Football Play and Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy. Your paper received a lot of press, and some neurologists in our audience may be getting a lot of questions from concerned parents whose children play football. What's the take-home message from your paper?
So very briefly, we show that there is a dose-response relationship between years of American football play and odds of developing CTE. And among individuals with CTE, we see a relationship between years of American football play and severity of disease.
And what exactly did your team find with regards to the duration of football play and the development of CTE?
So for each additional year of play, the odds of developing CTE increase by 30%. And that equates to, for each additional 2.6 years of football play, the odds double. We also looked carefully at selection bias, and we found that even after accounting for selection bias using inverse probability weighting and simulation, the estimated relationships remain stable.
First off, it's worth emphasizing that every year of play increases risk by 2.6. Is that?
No. So each additional year, the odds increase by 30%, and each 2.6 additional years, the odds double.
Wow. So that's significant increased risk with increased play. And maybe you can help our audience understand. So are we talking about pathological findings of CTE, or are we talking about symptoms that are prevalent or present or develop after ongoing football play?
Right. So this study made use of the VA Boston University Concussion Legacy Foundation Brain Bank, as well as the Framingham Heart Study Brain Bank. And the outcome in the study was purely neuropathological. So the development of CTE and the severity of CTE. Neuropathology in and of itself is not particularly useful if we can't correlate it with clinical information. And we're working really hard to understand the clinical pathological correlations in CTE, but it was beyond the scope of this paper.
Okay, so then maybe we can go into the pathology for a moment. So what pathological findings indicate CTE, and is that distinguished from other neurodegenerative disorders?
Sure. So CTE has a pathognomonic lesion that is accumulation of phosphorylated tau, i.e. neurofibrillary tangles, at the depths of the sulci in and around blood vessels. So this pathognomonic lesion, this perivascular lesion, is pathognomonic and only seen in CTE.
Okay, and then bringing this back to clinic for a moment. Hypothetically, if your friend has a 12-year-old son and they're asking whether it's all right for him to start playing football, what advice would you give to them at this point based on what you've learned here?
Medicine is an art. It's not a science. And for each individual, there's different risks and benefits that come with decisions. And I really view my role as giving them as much information as I can about risk. So they should know that there's no safe amount of football with respect to CTE. We find individuals who have only played 1 or 2 years who develop the disease. We also find individuals who play 14-plus years who don't develop CTE. But they should understand that with each additional year, there's increased risk, and that should inform what their decision is regarding play.
And it's great to have specific numbers that you can supply for your patient population, for friends and family, et cetera. So again, you're saying the odds of CTE double every 2.6 years of football played, but there are certainly nuances and differences in genetic backgrounds that make it such that some people go on to develop this and others don't. But at least in your study, which you mentioned the major criticism that you wanted to make sure we control for.
So individuals who donate to the brain bank, they tend to play more football than the general population, and they were probably more symptomatic than the general population of football players. Their family members were probably really interested in why they were demonstrating symptoms. And because of this difference in donation, it might be the case that the estimates that we find aren't generalizable to the general population of football players. We went out of our way using sophisticated approaches, inverse probability weighting, simulation, to show that even after accounting for selection into the brain bank, the relationships that we measured were largely consistent.
Okay, I think this is fantastic. So in the counselings you can have with patients or their families, we can say Dr. Mez's team has done their best to control for our selection bias. And the information that we have is that odds of CTE double every 2.6 years of football played, but there are certainly nuances that may or may not have this apply to the specific person in front of you. But again, I think it's really essential that we've got some data that we can present to people such that they know what the risk is. But as you mentioned, let me not put words in your mouth. There's no safe amount of football to play.
Right. So risk increases with each additional year, starting with 1 year. And we have individuals in the brain bank who played as little as 1 year who have CTE, but that risk is likely very small.
Is your team designing any studies going forward to try and develop more of a pathological clinical relationship between the severity of the pathology and the symptomatic presentation?
Sure. So I think this is an important point, that right now CTE can only be diagnosed neuropathologically postmortem. A major goal of our group's work is to diagnose CTE in life, not unlike the way Alzheimer's disease is diagnosed. And right now we have a multidisciplinary, multi-site effort to create diagnostic criteria to diagnose CTE in life.
Jesse, this is really groundbreaking work. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today. Jesse Mez has been speaking with us. He and his colleagues are the author of a paper published in the October 7th Annals of Neurology titled Duration of American Football Play and Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy. To hear our previous podcast, please listen back to the August 29, 2017 podcast with Jesse Mez as well. Jesse, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features a comparative study of posterior and anterior circulation stroke in childhood, and another article on sleep duration, midday napping, sleep quality, and incident stroke. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.